You are listening to California Burning, a co-production of North State Public Radio, made possible with generous contributions from Sierra Nevada Brewing Company. I'm Matt Fidler. All episodes of this series are available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts or at californiaburning.net. On this first episode of this five-part series, we're exploring the early days of U.S. forest management. If you've been following the coverage of any of the large wildfires in California over the last couple of years, you've probably heard people say this: California's forests are mismanaged, leading to both overgrown forests and a lot of dead trees, which gives the conditions to make wildfires burn hotter and more destructive. But no one wants dead trees and deadlier fire conditions, so how did this happen? Let me introduce you to Professor Char Miller.
I am a professor of environmental analysis and history at Pomona College, and I've been studying the U.S. Forest Service for way too long.
Char says that part of the mismanagement of the forests came from legitimate attempts to save them from complete destruction. In the 1890s, when the Forest Reserve Act was passed, most Americans only had a romanticized view of the West from pictures or maybe writings from someone like John Muir.
John Muir, the great naturalist, is romanticizing this Sierra, which he called the Range of Light, as if once you hike it, you would be close to the divine. The notion that Yosemite is this extraordinary place, which it is, penetrated American consciousness long before more than 1,000 white people had seen it. And so some of the romanticization is about that, right? Being tourist in a place that was wild. Some of it is predicated on the dispossession of native peoples, which is also part of what's going on. The sort of, quote, passing of the native populations meant that we're going to replace them. And that becomes part of the romance of the West also.
Yes. The genocide of the native peoples of California who took care of the land was the first step in mismanagement. And we're going to talk much more about that in later episodes. But the point is that well-off Americans, including members of Congress, started to have an infatuation with the idea of the West and started asking questions about the future of these beautiful landscapes and abundant natural resources.
So even at the moment those questions were being raised, there was a scholar by the name of George Perkins Marsh who wrote this extraordinary book called Man and Nature, Earth as Modified by Human Action.
This was a revolutionary book at the time when most people thought of any resource on any piece of land as a gift from God to be used and exploited for your own purposes. But Man and Nature suggested something a bit more profound.
And so it's Marsh who says, look, human beings modify the earth, despoil it, change it, radically alter its circumstances. And some of that is necessary for an economy to grow. Some of that is actually deleterious to that very economic growth across time. So Marsh is actually interested in sustainability. He doesn't use the term. The term he uses is stewardship.
This may not sound revolutionary now, but this was during the Civil War, and he's thinking about what we might call environmentalism.
In the midst of the Civil War, he's writing about a future that has yet to come and saying, you know, the Civil War thing, as bloody as it is, it's actually not the real issue. The real issue is whether the United States will survive its own economic aggression on nature.
And basically, this is one of the reasons why the Forest Reserve Act was passed and the National Forest became a thing. And it also was a major influence on the first chief of the United States Forest Service, Gifford Pinchot. Gifford Pinchot was born wealthy in rural eastern Pennsylvania. He spent most of his childhood out in nature, fishing, hunting, and getting to know the natural world.
His family had a phenomenal estate in Milford, Pennsylvania, and it's still there. It's called Gray Towers National Historic Site. But it was just being opened in 1886. They had just finished completion. And at that opening, which was set on August 11th, 1886, because his parents are real stage parents, it happens to be Gifford's 21st birthday. And what do they give him but a gilt-edged copy of George Perkins Marsh's book, Man and Nature?
Now, this is interesting because Gifford's family had clear-cut the forests around them, ravaging the landscape while making themselves rich, which was the way things were done back then. But by giving Gifford this book on his 21st birthday, his family was sending him a message.
So the family is arguing through this gift, look, we're going to clean up this place. We're going to actually regenerate the landscape. And for folks who might get a chance to go see Gray Towers, it worked. They actually did what they said they were going to do. But the really interesting thing is their ambition for their son was to do that work for the nation, which is why they give him Marsh's book.
And Gifford's family was pushing this idea of forestry to him. But forestry isn't a practice in the United States yet. So after graduating from Yale, he goes to Europe to learn from British foresters.
But once he got to Europe, he started talking with German foresters who were working for the British in India. So already, forestry is a global construct. And one of them said to him, look, you know French. Go to France. They have a great forestry school in Nancy. Go there and study. He went, all right, what the heck? I know how to study. So he spent about 6 months in Nancy. He traveled with German foresters all over Europe. He tramped all over the place to get a feel for what it meant to be a forester.
Pinchot is so passionate about doing this, he donates a large portion of his inheritance to Yale to start the first forestry school in the country.
And the moment that Yale announced this school, Harvard said, okay, we're in the game too. They started their own because, of course, Harvard and Yale are rivals. And the moment those two did it, every land-grant university in the United States said, what do these Eastern Ivy schools know about forestry? They know nothing. They've got no forest there. So they started it. And so by 1920, there's like 20 schools of forestry that have developed, all of whom are producing young men. It's all men at this point, who enter into a field that 20 years earlier didn't even exist.
So Congress creates the Division of Forestry with Gifford Pinchot as the first head of the department.
And by 1905, he had done what many would have thought was impossible. He managed to get a president, Teddy Roosevelt, who was really interested in what Pinchot was doing. He managed to get a greater and greater budget out of Congress that hadn't initially been interested in what he was doing. And so in 1905, when the Forest Service is created, it's now managing 150 million acres. It's an extraordinary political achievement that basically turns Marsh's ideas into political reality.
Which is, ironically, the next big step of mismanaging these forests. The first misstep was the killing of the native people and their culture, which took care of this land. But to take it to the next level of mismanagement was this new idea of forestry that Gifford Pinchot learned from Europeans and brought to America.
One of the chief worries that foresters had, whether they were practicing in Europe or India, and ultimately in the United States, was how do you protect the economic resource of timber? Because if timber is timber, and therefore is an economic asset, your goal is to protect that asset. And one of the most dangerous things they had to wrestle with, it's fire. And so one of the things he learned in Europe was you got to suppress fire.
As a passionate forester, Gifford Pinchot sparked the imagination of those in Congress who had never ventured out west before. But sparking a politician's imagination was different from actually getting money appropriated to fight these fires. To do this, it took a series of deadly fires like we've never before or since experienced. Just for a comparison, 2018 was the worst fire season in California's history, with almost 1.8 million acres being burnt. The fires of the Big Burn, which you're about to hear about, ravaged over 3 million acres.
1908, 1909, they're running like $35,000, $40,000 a year, which is serious money at that time. But in 1910, it would go to nearly $1 million.
And it was so much more than just the size of the agency that was to be forever changed by the events of 1910.
It was a great saga. I mean, it is a founding story. It is a creation story for American wildland fire.
That is Stephen Pine. He's a professor emeritus at Arizona State University.
I'm basically a fire guy and a historian.
And Char Miller is also sticking around to help with the story.
And I've been studying the U.S. Forest Service for way too long. I actually dream about it at times.
And yes, these two guys who study forest fires are named Pine and Char. So let's get back to where we left off in the early days of the Forest Service, where their main job was to protect natural resources like water and timber.
The first years were difficult. There was one fire guard for roughly every 670 square miles of national forest. You wonder, you know, these people are delusional. What were they imagining?
Because they were about to face their first real test of their ability to combat wildfire.
In 1908, a whole wave train of fires goes across the northern tier, U.S. and Canadian border, from Vancouver all the way to Maine, essentially.
Many of these wildfires were man-made, but there were plenty of lightning-ignited fires as well.
Part of what happened with the 1908 fires, if you look at the spread, where they blew up were in areas that were heavily logged, or mostly heavily logged.
Logging takes the big stuff and leaves the little. Well, fire burns the little stuff and leaves the big. So the stuff that logging left behind was exactly the kind of fuel that would drive large fires.
With these new fires, Gifford Pinchot started creating the first firefighting agency within the Forest Service.
In addition to not having anybody who's actually trained to fight a fire, is that they don't have the resources, the human resources to fight them.
They didn't know how much money they would need to spend for fires each year because they couldn't anticipate the size, number, and intensity of the fires. So they were given authorization to engage in emergency spending, do what they needed to do to meet the fires, then Congress would provide supplemental appropriations later.
The 1909 fire season was somewhat uneventful. Then in 1910, a cluster of fires starts around the northern Rockies.
The 1910 fires were mostly lightning. They were sparking off all over the eastern Washington, parts of Idaho and Montana.
The realm of the northern Rockies, and it was actually a very heavy, wet winter. But then spring came early and stayed. And so it's really the spring season that drove the fire season. The earliest serious fires were in June. A few showed up. But then it's really mid-July that the dry lightning season sets in.
And there's a sequence of how these big, dry fires progress.
The fires start. They blow up when dry cold fronts pass through, so the winds are driving things from the southwest. Then there's a shift, and they go to the southeast, and then it would settle down. Well, when they settled, all the smoke would settle into the valleys, so they couldn't see any of the new starts. If they do, there's not much they can do if it's any size, so except back off to the next ridge or two and then try to burn out that area. So this is a slow, laborious process, and it goes on for a month.
They're clearing brush down to the soil, making fire lines, but they just aren't making significant progress. These bands of laborers with basically no training are being led by foresters with farming tools and horses.
And so it's almost as if they were going to war without having any strategy, without having much of a budget, and not having many troops. That's not a recipe for success.
Early mid-August, appeals are made to call out the Army.
Because they need more professional teams of people. And for a bit, things seem to get a little more under control.
Well, in August 19, things had settled down, but that was the rhythm. They would blow up, then settle down.
And a few firefighters were even allowed to return home.
But on August 20th, the winds rose, this time much more seriously.
What many describe is a hurricane-level windstorm, 60 to 80 miles an hour.
No fire crew, no matter how brave or delusional, thinks they can fight a fire with those kinds of winds.
The crews looked up, and they realized that the sky was being obscured with this giant smoke ball to the west. The sun disappeared, the sky grew dark, and then night's going to come to add to it. You've got debris falling out of the sky miles ahead. Larger debris as you get closer. People are understandably terrified. And then they can see in the distance where they can see, many of them can't see very far, they see these towering flames soaring up into the sky.
And the whole time, you hear this deafening roar, making it all the more chaotic.
And one of the survivors described the sound as like 1,000 trains rushing over 1,000 steel trestles. They're enormously loud. And so all of your senses are being removed. You can't see anything. You can't hear anything. All you can feel is the heat.
The fire spread by this big blow-up burned over 2 million acres in 36 hours. Surviving firefighters brought home horrific stories of hellish scenes, as well as acts of great bravery. The most famous one was that of Forest Ranger Ed Pulaski. Firefighters know of him, or at least his last name, because of his invention, known as the Pulaski. Kind of a combination axe firefighting tool named after him. Well, at the time of the big blow-up, Ed Pulaski was leading a crew of 45 in the mountains near the town of Wallace, Idaho, when those ferocious winds carrying the fires descended onto his crew.
And said, it's time to get out. We're going down the West Fork of Placer Creek. We're going to try to reach Wallace. And so he's got everybody strung out, and they've got their horses, and they're holding on to tails or one another. They've got a few minor lamps that they're trying to use to help light the way.
Meanwhile, the sound of 1,000 trains coming from the fiery inferno.
Pulaski's running his men down the trails. One guy lags behind. He was found days later, burned. They mistook him for a stump originally. He finally tucks into a mine shaft, the Nicholson Adit, and tells them they're going to have to weather the firestorm. They can't outrun it. It's bearing down on them. And so they're in this relatively narrow canyon, this narrow ravine. They're in a small mine shaft. Everybody's in there, and then the fire comes. And Pulaski's at the entrance, trying to keep the timbers. There was a seep there, and they were trying to use the water to keep the timbers, the entry timbers, from catching fire. One guy, at least, in the back says, to hell with this, I'm getting out of here. And Pulaski stopped him by pulling his pistol and threatened to shoot the first man who tried to leave. Otherwise, there would be a general exodus, and they would all be killed in the flames.
There, Pulaski stood at the entrance to the mine shaft with a blanket that he kept wet from the water seeping into the mine entrance. He did this until he couldn't anymore. Eventually, the smoke became too much, and everyone inside the cave lost all consciousness. You're listening to California Burning. We're going to take a quick break and return to the story of Ed Pulaski. And learn about the long-lasting impact that these huge fires had on the Forest Service.
Everything is here. Everything that we know today was all rehearsed, all brought together for the first time in 1910.
Stay with us.